God and their responsibilities to him before this crisis of the decree that Haman was organizing started. After chapter 4, they are very definitely trusting in God, obeying God's commandments, doing the things that they are supposed to be doing. So, however you read Esther and Mordecai in this story, I think you have to admit that they don't start as good as they become later, and that chapter 4 is the sort of turning point of that growth. So, something their growth is something that's for us to celebrate and also to learn from. And that's really what I want to talk about tonight is the growth of their character and of their trust in God. We're now into the heart of the book where the stakes are clear. We all know what is potentially going to happen. If Esther and Mordecai can't save the day, all the Jews will die. So the stakes are high and they're clear. And this is the last section that builds tension. And after chapter 5 ends, it's kind of all downhill dramatically. So that's where we are in terms of the structure of the book. But as I said, in this chapter, we are really dealing with growth of character more than anything else. And I want us to read all of chapter 4 and most of chapter 5 all at once, because we're going to paint these character pictures, we're going to need all of the text at once. So if I could get someone to volunteer to read chapter 4, 17 verses, it's not that long, and someone else volunteer to read verses 1 through 8 of chapter 5. Okay. You want to read 4?
Yeah, I'll read chapter 4.
Okay. And Julia, sorry, read 5? Brain went to sleep. Okay, good. Start.
When Mordecai learned all that happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went as far as the front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And every province in the king's command and decree arrived, there was a great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. So Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her, and the queen was deeply distressed. Then she sent garments to clothe Mordecai and take his sackcloth away from him, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called Hapak, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend her, and she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. So Hapak went out to Mordecai in the city square and was in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that happened to him and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for the destruction, which was given at Shushan, and he might show it to Esther and explain to her, and that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. So Hathach returned to and told Esther the words of Mordecai. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a command to Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called, he has but one lot, put all to death except the ones whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. So they told Mordecai Esther's words. And Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do you think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews? For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go into the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him.
On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall facing the entrance. When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Then the king asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even if the half the kingdom, it will be given to you." "If it pleases the king," replied Esther, "let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I have prepared for him." "Bring Haman at once," the king said, "so that we may do what Esther asks." So the king and Haman went to the banquet Esther prepared. As they were drinking wine, the king again asked Esther, "Now what is your petition? It will be given to you. And what is your request? Even if to half the kingdom, it will be granted." Esther replied, "My petition and my request is this. If the king regards me with favor, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet I will prepare for them. Then I will answer the king's question."
Okay, and we read verses 9 through 14 last time. I'll make a couple of notes from that section at the end if we have time, but I think you know what happens. Haman builds the gallows for Mordecai. So let's talk about Esther first. How does Esther's character change in this chapter? What do you see in terms of growth or development or
She starts off being a little more assertive, and she's like, "Okay, why is everyone in sackcloth, Mordecai? What's going on?" And he's like, "This is the whole terrible thing that's going on. You need to do something about it." She's like, "If I go in there, ask her the law. If anyone goes in there not being announced, they'll be killed." And he replies back, "Hey, if you don't do this, something else will deliver this, but you're in the perfect position to do this." She's like, "Okay, I'm going to go in and do this." But then she's still not being extremely assertive. She's kind of circling around. So, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So the disconnection between people in the palace and the people outside is something that we observed at the end of chapter 3, right? That this, the king and Haman sit down to drink because they've just made this great law. They're going to have a party to celebrate. And all of Susa, the city, is in confusion. And, you know, certainly in, as far as the king is concerned, I think we would tend to read that ignorance of what's going on right outside his own house as a character flaw. That might be a little bit unfair, and probably more unfair in the case of Esther, who probably would not even be allowed to go out of the palace, that she doesn't know what's going on. I think the reason Mordecai comes where he does is not first to make her do something, it's to tell her what's going on, because there's no way she would know about this. And in fact, she doesn't, and so Haman has to tell her. Yes?
Throughout the earlier story, we've kind of seen Esther as a passive character.
Yes.
She doesn't seem to see herself as having a lot of agency, and I think you can see that in her first reply.
Yes.
Like, look, I'm just here.
Right.
You know, I'm here because I have to be. I don't really have any power here. And also, there's the aspect that she probably sees herself in a place of security. I mean, she is King's wife. So if there was to be anyone saved, it would be her. And Mordecai's answer changes her perspective position in two ways. Number one, it does become personal because he's like, you're not going to escape either. You know, this is going to come to you, so you're not going to escape from this. And number two, it changes her perspective of being the queen as something that's happened to her to something that has happened so she can do something.
Right.
You know, and that is a dramatic shift in her view of her position.
Yes.
I mean, it changes everything.
What's interesting about that point is the way Esther is described in the text. How is she described in chapter, once in chapter 4 and once in chapter 5? Not in people's dialogue, but in the actual, in the narration. It's, well, I have the verses here somewhere. So she's called the queen by the narrator in 4:4 and in 5:2. There's only one other place previously in the book where she's been called Esther the Queen or Queen Esther. Do you remember when that was? What?
Chapter 2, verse 22?
Yes. When, what's happening?
Mordecai's finding out about the plot to
kill the king, and he tells Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. agency, action, right? Every time Esther steps out and does something, she's called the queen. Every time she just, well, I don't know, I'm just here, she's called Esther. I think that's intentional in the, on the narrator's part, to demonstrate this growth of her character, to say that, yeah, she's been given this position, but it's not a real position, it's not a real opportunity until she makes something of it. And I think you see that in the way that it's that she is described here. So she gives commands to Mordecai. I love the way it says, Mordecai went away and did just as Esther had commanded him, because previously who had done just as the other one had commanded? Esther had not did not reveal her lineage and her family just as Mordecai had commanded her, for she did everything that he told her. Right? Remember that language. That language is reversed now. As Esther begins to take, as she begins to use the position that she's been given. She demonstrates a knowledge both of the laws of Persia and of the law of Moses. Persia, in the sense that she knows if she goes before the king on summons, she can be killed. Moses, the law of Moses, we'll talk a little bit more about this in a minute, but I've already mentioned in this class that these events that we're talking about in chapters 4 and 5 happened during Passover. And fasting during Passover would have been an extreme thing to do. And Esther, I think, knows that, and that's why she says this. I think that's why she commands them to fast. And I'll go into more detail about that later, but anyway. She recognizes and uses her powers, her power, limited as it is. And I'll say a little bit more about that in just a minute. But as we're pointing out, she's taking action for the first time in the book. I think it's maybe a kind of a typical woman thing that the first thing she does when Mordecai shows up in sackcloth and ashes is she sends him clothes, right? That seems like the kind of thing that a real woman would do, and not a fictional character. But anyway, she orders the Jews to fast along with her and her maids. She makes a plan and she executes it. That's a little bit subtle, but in chapter 5, when she goes into the king and says, and he, you know, extends the scepter towards her, he says, okay, what do you want? She says, come to the feast that I prepared. And they immediately go to the feast. Well, she already had to have had that ready. All the pots on the stove, you know, all the multitude of alcoholic beverages ready and waiting for the king. And so, clearly, she's prepared that feast before she goes in to see the king. And, of course, going into the king at the risk of her life. But in doing all this, I want us to see that it isn't just that she finally takes action, although that's important given the way she was acting earlier in the book. But more importantly, she's behaving wisely. And I've put some passages up here as kind of cross-references where this behavior that Esther exhibits is commended or even commanded in Proverbs and Psalms. I'm not going to read those, but if you want to write them down, you can look at it. But the point is that Esther is behaving in a way that is consistent with those who would obey God. She listens to Mordecai when he knows something that she doesn't about this decree. Proverbs has admonitions about listening to those who know more than you do. She entrusts herself to God for protection, which the psalmist says is exactly what God's people do. They don't rely on themselves, they rely on God. She works to honor the king, even as she's trying to undo his foolish action. She's trying to countermand his decree without undermining all of his authority, right? And in doing this, she uses subtlety, something that Haman apparently doesn't know how to do. He has to build gallows 50 cubits high to get things done. But Esther uses subtlety, and I think that's best demonstrated in, it's maybe a little bit speculative, but I think it's significant enough that it is worth considering. In chapter 4, Esther, or 5, verse 4, sorry, Esther says, if it pleases the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I've prepared for him. Well, fine, Haman's the grand vizier, it would not be, you know, totally weird that she would invite him. But then, at the end of the chapter, or at the end of the section, sorry, in verse 7 and 8, when the king says, okay, what do you want to do? By the way, the English translations smooth over what Esther says. She's interrupting herself, and she's doing it intentionally, I would argue, because she wants to show the king what she's doing. She says, more literally, it would be my petition and my request. If I have found favor in your sight, would you please come to dinner again tomorrow, and then I'll tell you what I really want. You see how she kind of starts to tell him, and says, whoa, you know, it's too presumptuous, I can't do that, I can't disobey the authority of my husband, I can't, you know, undermine his headship in the house. She's intentionally, you know, pulling back and being kind of subtle and coy about this in order to achieve the end that she wants. But then in verse 8, she invites the king and Haman to the banquet again tomorrow. And some have speculated that there's not a lot of reason for her to invite Haman back again. I mean, you could kind of think of the first invitation as she goes in the middle of a court meeting and says, you guys want to come to dinner. That's one thing. It's another thing at the dinner to issue the invitation for the next night when you don't have to invite everybody and intentionally invite another man to a meal with your husband. You see how that's a little bit different? And so maybe what Esther is doing is starting to sow these seeds of anxiety in the king's mind about her relationship with Haman. We're going to see reasons why he might be thinking along these lines as we move into chapter 6. But I'll just give you a hint. Remember where the king finds Haman when he comes back after Esther has said Haman is the enemy. And the king leaves and he comes back and Haman is, you know, grabbing onto Esther's robe, trying to plead with her, which to the king, really or just conveniently, looks like Haman is assaulting his wife. But maybe what Esther's doing is sowing those seeds of a different kind of relationship with Haman in the king's mind. We'll explore that more a little bit later, but I think that and the fact that she kind of interrupts herself and is very deferential to her husband and doesn't presume to demand things from him is evidence of her, you know, behaving wisely, using some subtlety in her actions. Yes.
And also this absolute plays to Haman's ego, so he's not expecting.
That's right. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I don't know how well Esther would have known Haman before this, but it does certainly, I mean, he says that. He says, Leo, look at this, you know, I got invited to dinner. And so either by her own wisdom or providentially, it certainly worked out that way. And then the last thing I would say, this is maybe, I think all of these are applications for us, right? To take charge of the things that you've been given to take charge of, to take action when the action needs to be taken, to behave wisely. But maybe this is the most important one, to act without positional authority, as Esther does, because she doesn't have the authority to directly countermand this order. She can't just go, okay, new law, you know. She can't even do something more along the lines of like what the first ladies in our country would be able to do, which would be to, by their own political power, to sort of influence things to happen the way they want. She doesn't have any of that. All she can do is basically plead with her husband to change this. So she doesn't really have the official position to be able to do this, the positional authority, but she uses the resources that are available to her, which are her access to the king, risky, because she might be killed, but she has that, and she has the advice of Mordecai. And she uses those things, the information that Mordecai gives her, and her access to the king, to begin working. And I think it's not coincidental, therefore, that she is called Queen Esther in these two chapters as a result of that. Anything else about Esther's growth and development in these chapters? Okay, so Esther goes. This is a map of the court. Esther goes into the throne room, which is here, and the king's gate is here. This is where Mordecai is, and one of the things I want us to see in this map is proximity. That yeah, Mordecai's here, and he can't get in here. He probably wouldn't have been allowed in there anyway. Probably Mordecai, his normal seat would have been either here or potentially here. This is the what I showed you a map of the other day, or I mean a photograph of the ruins of that. But it's possible that he would have had access into the sort of perimeter area here. But not with sackcloth and ashes on, as the text says. He's confined to outside the king's gate, in fact. Meanwhile, Esther's operating in this area, somewhere in here, the throne room, you can see this is kind of, you know, buried in the middle of the palace, and you can just imagine Esther going in for this fateful meeting where she might not even come out of it alive, and she's got to walk all this way, past all these courtiers, past all these, you know, guards with weapons and all kinds of stuff like that. You can imagine how terrifying that would have been for her. But the other thing that proximity helps us to understand is how fast everything is happening. Haman passes or gets his law signed into effect on the first month, Nisan. And I think we are to understand that chapter 5 happens the same day, or the very next day. It's very quickly after that. And I apologize for having that line in your lesson from chapter 3. But anyway, when Mordecai learned all that had been done, that's an immediate action. So the city's in confusion. Mordecai realizes what this means. I wonder if he also realizes that he's kind of responsible for this to a certain extent, right? His actions have angered Haman. So he tears his clothes and he runs and puts, you know, sackcloth and ashes on, runs to the gate. And this conversation between Esther and Mordecai happens, you know, probably in only slightly longer than it took us to read the text, because the messengers are delivering the messages back and forth, but they'll be moving pretty fast. And then Esther says, okay, start fasting, and 3 days later she goes into the king. So we're at the beginning of the story, there were big gaps of time where, you know, nothing is recorded, but now we're almost in a minute-by-minute record of what is happening in the story. Mordecai is over here, Esther is in here somewhere, and the messengers are running back and forth. So now we talked about Esther, let's talk about Mordecai. Mordecai says the line that everybody knows from the book of Esther. Mordecai told him to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you and the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this." When we studied Ruth, we talked about providence, and we talked about it a little bit in this class. But I'd like us to talk about it a little bit more, because I think this statement of Mordecai is important for our understanding of providence, not just in the book of Esther, but in the Bible and in God's work as a whole. So, what lessons do you see about providence here? You don't have to limit yourself to these two verses. This is just a springboard.
Well, Mordecai understands that deliverance is what most likely come to him, whether by Esther or by some other one.
Good. And why would he have understood that?
Why would he have understood that? Because maybe he knew more about God than he gave him credit.
Yeah.
Some of us give him
credit. Right. I never said you didn't know it. I just said you didn't do it. Not the same thing, as I've proved many times. That's an important lesson about providence, right? That in order to understand providence, we have to understand what God says in the Bible. It's not just, oh, this worked out well for me, so that must be God. It has to be founded on a knowledge of who God is and what He has done in history, and also, importantly, the promises that He has made to His people. Right. So that's very important. Yes.
Kind of a more depressing one, but if we're remembering right, that this is after the main group of Jews were able to return back to Jerusalem.
Yes.
Mordecai knows that the Jews that are in Persia aren't the only Jews in the world, and like there's always been this thing about God promising there will always be a remnant left. So like,
right.
He knows that even if all the Jews in Susa are wiped out, there's still the main group that's back in Jerusalem.
Well. except that the decree is for the entire kingdom. It's published in every language, and it's sent out by messengers to the ends of the kingdom, which would have included Judea and Jerusalem. Yeah, so it's, like I said, the stakes are pretty high here, and it's pretty serious. Yes?
I read this little interaction between Mordecai and Esther. Well, the other story that always comes to mind is the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego when they're talking to Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah.
And when they're talking the fire, they exude a similar faith, I think, that Mordecai exudes. Mordecai being like, this is going to happen. It's kind of like he's more or less saying what side of history you want to be on. Do you want to be on the side that makes the change, or do you want to be on the side watching it? And I see that with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego saying, we will be saved, and if we're not, we're still going to believe in God.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because I'm gonna come back to that. I had not thought about that, but I'm going to try to come back to that verse in just a second if I can. So I want to talk about providence maybe in two ways. One is to talk about God's work in providence, and the other is to talk about our work. So God's work in providence, which we've already kind of hit on, Larry's hitting on all these, is, first of all, that he's going to keep his promises. It's consistent with his nature. And among those promises are that he's going to save his people. Define that however you will. God saves his people. But also, God rewards good and punishes evil. But as a kind of a sort of caveat or a condition on all of these, of course, is that part of God's work in providence is that he does all these things which he has promised to do in his own time and in his own ways. And as we are trying to determine whether something has happened providentially, we have to consider that God works in his own time and his own way. So just because it happened right at the moment that I needed it doesn't necessarily mean it's from God. It doesn't mean it isn't. It just means that we have to consider that God works in his own time and in his own way. But I think the numerous parallels that we've been highlighting between Esther and the other Old Testament stories emphasize God's faithfulness to his part of the work of providence. So they are more than coincidental, these parallels between Esther or between Mordecai and Joseph, and between Esther and Daniel and his friend. Good or bad, whether they come out of looking favorable or not, these parallels are intentional, and they are intended to help us see that even though God's not named, he is very much at work keeping his side of the score sheet in the work of providence. For our work in terms of providence, I would just say that Esther demonstrates that we have a responsibility to take risks by faith, to do difficult things by faith, trusting that God will keep his side of the score sheet. We have to trust God to do his work, and that may seem like it contradicts this one, right? But I don't think it does. I think sometimes what it means to trust God to do his work is to do my work, trusting that God will provide the other half. To sow the seed, trusting that God will provide the harvest. It doesn't let us off acting just because we trust God to do his work, but we have to have that trust in place in order for our action to really be meaningful. This is kind of a complex one. To set priorities and meet the current need while respecting God's commandments. And what I mean by this is that Esther has the Jews in Susa, all of them, fast for 3 days during Passover, a time of feasting and rejoicing and celebration of what God had done for Israel. And Esther says, no, we're going to fast. So, is she telling them to violate the Passover? I don't think so. I think what she's doing is saying that this priority here is more important than this priority, and as long as doing this doesn't make us disobey this other law, then we're okay. The best modern example that I can think of is if, you know, you're headed into worship from Bible class and somebody grabs you and says, I need to talk to you right now. This is really important. I'm really sorry. It can't wait. I need to talk to you right now. Are you committing a sin by not going to worship because you stopped to help your brother or your sister who has an urgent need, especially if it's a spiritual one? Right? So you see how we are commanded to worship, but we're also commanded to care for the weak and to strengthen those who are in need of help. And if that means that we have to do that during worship, I don't think we're doing anything wrong. And I think that's what Esther is asking them to do. And I think it's a good example for us to not let the things that we know we have to do get in the way of the things that come up unexpectedly that require our action. And then the last one, which is maybe the most important one, is to not pretend to know God's work or plans. In other words, to say, by faith, as Mordecai says, who knows whether you have come into the kingdom at such a time as this? He doesn't say you have. He says, who knows? And what's interesting about that phrase, who knows, is he's not the only person who says that. David says that in 2 Samuel chapter 12 when he's praying for the child with Uriah that died, right? And the child dies, and they're afraid to tell him, and he says, is the child dead? And they say, yeah, he is. And he gets up and he washes, and they say, why did you do that? Why were you, you know, weeping and mourning before, and now you've cleaned yourself up? And he says, while the child was still alive, I was praying because who knows whether God would change his mind. In Joel says something very similar regarding the punishment that was promised to Judah, I think. I can't remember offhand. But it's basically, if you will repent, who knows whether God will spare you. And in exactly the same way, the king of Nineveh says, who knows, in Jonah chapter 3, where Jonah preaches, and his message is, you're going to die. And the king says, okay, well, let's all repent in sackcloth and ashes. Who knows whether God will spare us? You see how these people are acting. They're taking risks. They're acting by faith. They're doing the things that they know they're supposed to do because they don't know what God's going to do. And I think that's maybe a better interaction with providence. Not to say, God gave me this parking space, but to say, maybe God is working. Maybe God is working through this parking space, but more importantly, what use am I going to make of this? And there are some other examples here of people who use similar language of perhaps or it may be. And the reason that I'm glad Scott mentioned Daniel is the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say the same thing. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you that we are not going to serve your gods. Right? So they are acting extremely boldly, extremely faithfully, but they're saying, I don't know what God's going to do. Even when I'm obeying him, even when I'm putting my life on the line, and he's promised that, you know, he will preserve his people, I don't know what God's going to do. So I think the applications for us first are to focus on using rather than identifying moments of providence, right? In all of these examples, and especially in Esther, the fact that God has worked out some providential situation doesn't just mean that now Esther has a place to sleep. It's Esther now has work to do as a result of what God has worked out providentially. So when it seems like something providential has happened to us, a new job or a good friendship is formed or something like that, I would encourage us not to take that moment to pat ourselves on the back and say, well, isn't it nice that God did that? And rather take that moment to say, okay, great, now I've got this additional resource, this additional opportunity. What can I do with this? That's the lesson, I think, that Esther would have us learn about, one of the lessons about providence. Yes?
I think also at the exact same time it can be very easy for us to look at like the things like a new job or someone
right.
And say that, oh, this is for sure a problem. But I'm sure at the beginning of her being basically like forced into this whole situation, being forced to, you know, sleep with this guy and get married to him, that would not seem like prominence like
yeah.
whatsoever.
Yeah.
I'm sure she would have sworn up and down that this is just terrible stuff said by the devil and not all by God.
Right.
You know? So I think, you know, it's also that as well.
That's a really good point, because my second application was actually be very hesitant to speak for God or to be definite about what God has done, because you just don't know. I'm going to read a section from this book that I've been using, because I think he captures this very well. The reality is that without some kind of special revelation, people simply cannot know for certain what God is up to in their lives, and there should be humility in regard to this. There may be plausible guesses, or, like Joseph, the benefit of decades worth of hindsight may clarify God's working, but having certainty about God's working in the very moment is impossible and dangerously presumptuous. That great job offer, for example, may not have come from God's storehouses of blessing, but from Satan's bag of temptations. Only time will tell. In Scripture, the great people of faith spoke much more hesitantly about God's dealings in their lives. Who knows, and perhaps were standard expressions. Their hesitancy does not detract from their faith. They clearly believed God was active, and He may well be working in that specific way, but they had the humility to allow for God to be sovereign, for His ways are unsearchable and unknowable, and for Him to reveal His purposes and plans on His own timeline. Just as Mordecai expressed uncertainty about God's working, the best human response is not to claim knowledge of God's working, but to trust that He is, and to let God be God. I found that very helpful as a kind of a way of thinking about how we respond when good or bad things happen to us and determining, you know, whether God is at work in it. In the end, the question is, what use will you make of the situation? And I think Esther and Ruth both exemplify working in God's providence by taking a situation that they've been given and making the situation they've been given and making the best use that they can of it. Abby?
I think for people of faith, the idea that everything happens for a reason is somewhat of comfort, which is good. But it's a double-edged sword because there was a girl I knew, several traumatic things that happened to her, and her faith was shaken by it. If everything happens for a reason, then why did this happen? And I can't see anything of it. So that more middle-of-the-road way of looking at it is beneficial not only for people of faith but outside because, again, there's more forces at play. Overall, God is in charge of everything, but it allows you to focus more on what am I going to do than trying to find the rhyme and reason for why these things have happened.
Yeah, but even the everything happens for a reason explanation, maybe the reason is to shake you out of your complacency and strengthen your walk with God, right? But as you say, it's a matter of perspective, Russ.
Yeah, that was my original comment, but to that comment, I think that when those kinds of bad things happen, there is a lesson we should learn from it, but it's a bigger lesson. It's not a particular lesson. It's not a specific lesson to me, and that's what oftentimes we're looking for. These series of things happen to me, God is telling me something. What God tells us in the Scriptures is that bad things happen because there is a Satan, there is evil, there will come a day of judgment. There are a number of bigger pictures that really, frankly, that is exactly what we should be awakened to and see and recognize in those, but not something that comes back to me specifically. But just in regard to providence, it seems like that what you're saying and what this is, our confidence in it, or when we think we see providence, it ought to drive us toward gratitude and toward motivation to do the right thing, as opposed to sometimes what it, the thought of providence is, it drives us toward making a decision. I guess that's what you mean by in the moment, particularly. Like, we think we see it.
Right.
So here's an opportunity. So God is telling me I need to do this or I shouldn't do that. Well, I may have nothing to do with that. But we're always motivated to do the right thing. And I think that being confident that God has providentially done things in the past, whether I'm right or wrong about them, if it drives me to gratitude, I've only gained from that.
Yep.
Even if I'm wrong
about
it, I'm still not wrong about I need to be grateful to God for it.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I want to quickly get through this slide to get to the next one. There are some important connections between Esther and Moses. They're both foreigners who were made part of the royal court and without their input. They are, at some point, they determined to identify with their people rather than with the royals they're associated with, the nation they're associated with. They have to be persuaded to take action when they're called upon. Mordecai has to say, no, you really need to do this. And remember, Moses is like, oh, I don't speak very well, says the guy who was trained in the Egyptian court. They have to appear before powerful kings at the risk of their own life. Remember, Pharaoh told Moses, if I see your face again, you're going to die. And Esther is obviously at risk in the story as well. And they both established Feasts of Deliverance. Feasts of Deliverance, by the way, which happened like back-to-back in the Jewish calendar because this first phase of the deliverance is happening during Passover. Anyway, but the parallels through Moses and Esther, as they develop through the book, I think what it does is to foreground God's work behind the scenes.
So we think about all the things in Moses' life that we just go, yeah, God was doing that, right? The parents found it, they found him beautiful, so they didn't expose him in accordance with the command. The ark that they put him in didn't sink, it didn't get eaten by a crocodile. You know, I mean, that was just an accident. Well, no, we didn't say that was God at work. Pharaoh's daughter found him and liked him and decided to raise him as her own son instead of, like, the local milkmaid or somebody, right? All those things, we go, yeah, God had a hand in that, God had a hand in that, God had a hand in that. And then we look at Esther, and we go, well, I don't know. I don't know if God had a hand in that or not. And I think these parallels help us to see that the author of Esther is deliberately highlighting these parallels between known, in quotes, cases of providence and Esther's story. So this is just for audiovisual purposes. This is a relief of a court scene. You can see the king sitting on the throne. This is Darius, Xerxes' father. That's probably Xerxes right there. So this is the generation before Esther. But sitting on the throne, in the throne room, guy's bowing down right here, and he's got the scepter that he can extend to welcome someone who's come in unbidden. All right, I wanted to get to this because I think this is really important. I think there are some really key parallels between Esther and Christ that we need to see in this book. I'm not going to say we need to see them to understand the book properly in its Old Testament context, but probably from our perspective in a New Testament context, we probably do need to understand the book along these lines. The first are the similarities between Esther and Christ that show the continuity of character of God's providential work. In other words, God always works the same way. Because he is consistent with himself, and because he controls things, he doesn't have to come up with a plan B. So Esther and Christ both interceded at the beginning of Passover. That's when Esther's preparations to go in before the king start, and that's when Christ is crucified. Haman's edict is written on the eve of Passover, meaning that Esther fasts starting on the first day of Passover. And we are assuming in that this happens the next day. But given the way the text reads, I don't think that's an unfair assumption. They also both suffer to make intercession. This is a little bit more subtle, but I think it's there. Fasting in Scripture is often associated with affliction and humiliation, that you are making yourself worse off physically in order to humiliate yourself spiritually so that you can be useful for God's service. But as the Hebrew language develops, but still before you get to the time of Christ, the terms for fasting and humiliation are used synonymously. And so fasting is associated with this humiliation and affliction, even to the extent that it's kind of viewed as a small version of death, almost. You're cutting yourself off from the land of the living. You're not doing the things that living people do, like eating and drinking. And then after 3 days of that, they both arose, and they both put on royalty. Again, the Hebrew in Esther 5, the translations don't do it justice. It says she put on her royal apparel. It actually literally just, she put on royalty. And that just reminds me of Christ being crowned with glory and honor and ascending before the Father. And at the end of the book, we'll see they both bring many nations to become God's people. And so Esther 5:1, about the third day, may provide part of the answer to 1 Corinthians 15:4. Why does Paul say Christ was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures? Where is the third rising from the dead on the third day prophesied in the Old Testament? It isn't. But there is a pattern of salvation on the third day. I've got some examples here. And Esther is a good match to that pattern. But more importantly, it's the example in that pattern that is most parallel to Christ for these reasons that I've just outlined. So I think what we have in Esther 5:1 is, in fact, a messianic type that Christ fulfilled by rising from the dead on the third day. We can explore that more if you've got questions or whatever. I appreciate your attention. We'll pick up in chapter 6 next time. Thanks, Mr. Hamid.